You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko India toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mo tēnei rā. Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for Tuesday the 15th of August. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the controversy over an AUSA member asking for there to be a vote whether anti-abortion and anti-euthanasia group should be disaffiliated from the university. An Australian constitutional law professor rates the chances of Australia's Deputy Prime Minister, Barnaby Joyce, staying in office after he was revealed to be a New Zealand dual citizen. This week, with Māori Party co-leader Marama Fox, we discuss National's proposed military camp for youth criminals. On the Green Desk with Lily Peacock, we talk to the Waipua Forest Trust. A social work expert explains the comparisons drawn between the controversial youth camp on Great Barrier Island and National's proposed camp. Finally, we speak to documentary maker Briar March about her new short film about a group of elderly who come together to make their own coffins. If you want to let us know your thoughts on any issues we cover, please give us a call 309 3879 or a text on 5395.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
A member of Auckland University Students Association has put in a question as to whether anti-abortion group and anti-euthanasia group Pro-Life Auckland should be disaffiliated from AUSA. Since they were reaffiliated in 2012, this is the third time an AUSA member has challenged their association with the university. This association allows them to book meeting rooms and apply for funding. As well as asking whether the group should be disaffiliated, it asks whether all groups with similar ideology should be disallowed from seeking affiliation. Yesterday we spoke to Sarah, who used to run Auckland Feminist Club, about whether the group has a role on campus.
I'm sure that they think they have a purpose to save those children. I mean, I do think it's offensive and undermining to women and what they know about their bodies. There's also no evidence ever that pro-lifers stop abortions happening. I think they just make people feel bad.
This morning we spoke to AUSA President Will Matthews to get an update on the situation and the outcome of a meeting between AUSA and Pro-Life Auckland.
So AUSA operates a referendum process that allows any member to submit a question. The AUSA's returning officer is able to decline questions on the basis of a few criteria, but a question that states that the pro-life club be disaffiliated and that all clubs with similar ideology be prevented from affiliating in the future has gone through to the referendum.
Pro-Life Auckland have come to you with some concerns that they have with this, and can you tell me what their main concerns are?
Yeah, well, obviously they're concerned at the prospect of their club being disaffiliated from AUSA. On top of that, they believe that the question itself contradicts AUSA's constitution, and they argue that it's a suppression of their rights to free speech and assembly, etc.
And what do you think of those concerns?
So it's a really interesting argument, and one that AUSA has had a lot before, kind of centres on definition of the kind of organisation that AUSA is, whether it's a public entity or not. I'm very confident that the question itself doesn't breach AUSA's constitution, though the executive has authorised me just to seek a legal opinion to back that up.
What's the next step for AUSA? Will you sort of see what comes out of that opinion as to whether you'll vote on it next week?
Yeah, so I obviously, if we have an opinion that the question is in breach of any legislation or a constitution, then we can't continue the question. It'll be removed. If the opinion is that the question is perfectly legitimate, then I don't think we have a mandate to remove it, and it has to go forward to be voted on by students.
So for the members of AUSA who oppose the group, can you tell me what their major concerns are?
I wouldn't be able to tell you. Any member, any student at the university who is a member of AUSA can submit a question. They are entitled to submit a short blurb explaining their question, and the person who submitted this question on Pro-Life hasn't done so. There will be a special student forum on Wednesday to discuss the question, and at that point anyone who is in favour of the motion can give their views.
Was there anything else that you wanted to add?
I think the key message that we want to get out, and we released a statement about this yesterday, is that this motion hasn't come from AUSA as an organisation has not been endorsed by AUSA. It's come from a single AUSA member. There are 15,000 of them. I would just want to make sure that our members understand the facts of the situation with regard to where the motion has come from. It doesn't reflect an AUSA position or opinion in any way. AUSA is obliged to act as a mediator of this discussion that has been started by students.
To understand the distinction, The
Wire. This morning I also spoke to Yelena Middleton, the co-president of Pro-Life Auckland. She became a member of the group earlier this year. I began by asking her whether she has experienced any other controversies during her time in the group.
Not to this extent. We did get a few emails saying how they didn't like our flyers. They didn't like that we were putting them in sort of tutorial rooms and lecture rooms, but definitely nothing to this extent, no.
When did you become aware that AUSA was voting on Pro-Life Auckland from being disaffiliated from AUSA?
Last Friday, we were emailed about it, and yeah, that was the first we heard of it.
So what are your main concerns with the referendum?
Okay, so the main concern about this is it all seems rather dodgy, to be honest. The wording of this amendment is really vague. No reason has really been given for it, and it's completely anonymous. So we actually don't know what we're being levelled with or what we're being charged with at any point. We also this is a free speech issue, to be honest. You know, someone is trying to silence us because they disagree with us, and you know, we have peacefully held views. So that's another problem I really have with this. And it's very, you know, it's so vague that it's really going to create an atmosphere on campus where any club could be banned, really, at any time if someone doesn't like you. And I don't think clubs can operate in a safe and democratic environment, you know, with that sort of threat over their heads.
You met with AUSA yesterday. Can you tell me how this meeting went from your point of view?
Okay, so, yes, we met with Will Matthews. It was an interesting meeting. I think a lot of it, there was some arguing on semantics. You know, what is and isn't bias? What is and isn't a leading question? And I think that was all pretty vague, to be honest, because they don't seem to think this is bias. And I think when you target one club for no apparent reason, that screams bias to me. You know, there's no good reason that's been given.
So it is going to be brought to a vote. So would you say that even if people did vote that the group was disaffiliated, you would consider that undemocratic?
Yes, to be honest, I would, because the voting itself is not particularly what we have a problem with. The fact that it's been allowed to go through for no objective reason, especially not one that's been given, that is biased. And I don't think that's safe or democratic, because you know, a democracy is where many different voices of many different opinions and views should be allowed to be heard. And we're going to be limited and we're going to be restricted. And as far as I can see, we've done nothing to deserve that. We're a peaceful group. We haven't really done anything worthy of this.
So I have seen a few people saying, yeah, that they did find being confronted with your messaging in their tutorials in places where they don't expect it and sort of, you know, just want to get on with their studies, that's a bit of a worry. If the question was about something more specific, like not disseminating your material in lecture rooms and tutorials because it's offensive, would you have a problem with this?
Well, I would want to know why, because our message isn't supposed to be antagonistic. It's not supposed to be any form of harassment. It's simply another viewpoint that's being brought, just like any other viewpoint that's being brought to the students. You know, many other groups, you know, that they leave flyers, they advertise their groups. I actually see no reason why we cannot do the same. You know, we don't mean to upset anyone. It's simply another viewpoint, and I don't see any problem with that. And I would have a problem with that restriction, yes.
So when you say that you can't understand why, do you mean that you can't understand why abortion might be a sensitive issue that some people don't want to be confronted with at university?
Oh, no, I understand that it can be a sensitive issue for some, and I'm more than sympathetic towards that. However, I do believe a university, you know, it's a place of tertiary learning. You know, we're supposed to be open to ideas, to different viewpoints. That's really what university is about. And I think of all places, really, this is an institution where these sorts of viewpoints need to be heard. But I am, of course, sympathetic towards women who do find it sensitive. Yes.
The Wire.
That's funny. What does it sound like?
Australian New Zealand dual citizenship has caused another stir in Canberra after Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce was revealed to be a New Zealand citizen yesterday. Under Australian Constitution, anyone with dual citizenship cannot stand for federal election. Inquiries made by Australian media led to New Zealand Internal Affairs to announce Joyce as a dual citizen because his father was born here. But unlike two Green senators who have already stepped down after discovering their New Zealand citizenship, Joyce is staying on. He says the legal advice he's received suggests he won't be disqualified by Australia's constitution and points out his father moved to Australia in 1947, a year before dual citizenship was created. Reporter Max Smith spoke to Anne Twomey, a professor of constitutional law at the University of Sydney Law School, and asked her whether Barnaby Joyce was really in the clear.
No, not at all. I have looked through the laws and it's always possible I've missed something, but from my tracing of the law back, no, that's completely irrelevant. The issue here is whether or not at the time when Barnaby Joyce was born in Australia, whether at that time his father was a New Zealand citizen or not. And that's the key issue. Interestingly, I found this out in relation to myself as well. My father is also a New Zealander, and he definitely was at the time I was born. And so I've discovered that I accidentally have dual citizenship with New Zealand too, which I was pretty chuffed about. So there you go.
So you won't be running for Parliament anytime soon, I guess.
No, I won't. So I'm not so worried about it, not being a Member of Parliament. But it does show that it has been a bit surprising to many of us, these rules about dual citizenship. But the reality is, from the New Zealand laws, at least the ones that I've looked at, it seems that so long as his father was a New Zealand citizen at the time he was born, at the time Barnaby was born, then on that basis he would have New Zealand citizenship by descent, and there was no requirement for registration or anything else at that time. So no active actions needed to be taken, and that citizenship was preserved by the changes made in the 1977 Citizenship Act. So that seems to be the situation, but what I don't know is whether his father was still a citizen of New Zealand at the time that Barnaby Joyce was born. That's the key issue.
But that would require his father to have rescinded his citizenship.
That's right. Now we do know that his father did become an Australian citizen at some stage. So one possibility is that at the time he became an Australian citizen, he might have rescinded his New Zealand citizenship. Seems unlikely. But if he did, then Barnaby Joyce would have no problems at all. The problem will arise if he didn't rescind his New Zealand citizenship and continued to hold it, then there will be a problem for Barnaby Joyce. I mean, the reality is, if he wasn't validly elected, all that would happen was that they'd hold a by-election in his electorate and he would most likely win it. So from that point of view, it's not catastrophic. But given that the government at the moment has a one-seat majority, they're probably not really looking forward to that. So it is slightly problematic.
Right. And you don't think that because he's in such a... I mean, this is the highest profile of those we've seen so far with the dual citizenship. Because he's Deputy Prime Minister, do you think that makes it a more complicated case?
Well, not for the courts. I mean, it doesn't matter what his position is in terms of a court making a decision. What does make it more complicated is that this is a case of citizenship by descent rather than citizenship by birth. So clearly those who were in the position where they had citizenship by birth ought to have been aware of it and therefore investigated it before they became members of parliament and renounced. It's a lot harder, however, if it's simply citizenship by descent and you didn't know that you had that descent. So that arises in relation to another member of parliament who had Italian citizenship by descent without knowing it. And it arises in relation to Senator Joyce as well. So it is possible that the High Court would decide that it was only citizenship by birth that gives rise to these problems and not citizenship by descent. Or it's also possible that the High Court might decide, well, the point of the dual citizenship provisions is to make sure that people have a sole allegiance. You couldn't have had an allegiance that was divided if you didn't actually know you had citizenship of another country. Therefore, not knowing you had foreign citizenship might save you. The reality is we just don't know what the High Court would decide about it.
No doubt this will only encourage politicians to do further checks on whether they fall under this category, if they didn't know already if they were dual citizens. But I mean, where do you think all this is going? Are we just going to see a kind of mass exodus of politicians trying to get out before they're caught out? Or, I mean, because there's potentially a lot of people that are affected by this. I mean, you yourself obviously
said. There are, indeed. Well, look, you know, many of us didn't know that this business of citizenship by descent, you know, actually operated. But having said that, had I actually ever been running for Parliament, I would have done some due diligence to sort this out, but that's probably because I'm a constitutional lawyer and I care about these things. I think this does show that people haven't been trying particularly hard to comply with the Constitution before they run for Parliament. I think one of the big problems in this is the interpretation of the High Court, which has said that the critical date is the date at which you nominate. It would have made a much more sense for them to say, well, the critical date is the date of the return of the writ, so that if a person had actually been elected at the polls, they would have a period of time to make sure that they got their house in order before the writs were returned and they were formally elected. That would solve a few problems because, you know, for many people, who are running for election but probably don't have a hope of being elected, you probably don't want to ditch your dual citizenship or other things beforehand, and probably it's only if you get to the position that you are elected that you're prepared to do that. So changing the timing of it, which is a matter of High Court interpretation, it's not set out in the Constitution. The Constitution just refers to being chosen, and it depends on how the High Court interprets that. So fixing that would actually be one way to help deal with the problem.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te waia, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
That was Anne Twomey, a professor of Constitutional Law at the University of Sydney Law School, talking about Australia's Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce having dual citizenship. Next up, we speak to Māori Party co-leader Marama Fox. First, we have a quick break.
Flying out and 95BFM present the Others Way Festival, Friday, September 1st, all around Kay Road. The best of New Zealand is coming to Kay Road with Beck Runga, Lawrence Arabia, The Courtneys, Micronism, Sneaky Feelings and heaps more. The Others Way 2017. Tickets from Flying Out and online at flyingout.co.nz and undertheradar.co.nz. Limited early bird tickets available. Thanks to Karma Cola, Coffee Supreme, Kate Sylvester, Kay Road Business Association, Going Global Music Summit, Garage Project, APRA AMCOS NZ, One Music and Phantom Bill Stickers.
Bye, Mum. I'm taking a boat over to Kay Road.
Okay, dear. Have you got your lead hat?
Yes.
Is your enviro suit all sealed up?
Yes, Mum.
Have you de-pooed some drinking water?
Mostly.
Okay, and be careful. The man who delivers the food paste says there's still some frothing climate change deniers in the water over Grafton Gully. Oh, and son?
Yes?
We might be home late. Your father and I are being sent back in time to rescue Lily Peacock and save the planet from climate disaster.
Hooray! Alternate future. Wait, will I still be born?
Want a better future for the planet? Listen into The Green Desk with Lily Peacock every Tuesday on The Wire on 95BFM. Thanks to the Manukau Beautification Charitable Trust.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
National's facing criticism over its proposed military camp scheme for dealing with serious young offenders. Prime Minister Bill English announced the policy on Sunday, promising to send up to 50 young offenders each year to a new training facility at Wairu Military Camp. Māori Party co-leader Marama Fox told reporter Max Smith the plan won't help to address problems with youth crime.
It's time to chat politics with Māori Party co-leader Marama Fox.
This is punitive action for some of these young offenders who probably, if this course doesn't include dealing with the underlying causes of why they've become criminalised in the first place, then all you're doing is pacifying a sitting powder keg. Because PTSD, you know, the effects of either sexual abuse or physical abuse and intense harm has caused, I can guarantee, 80% at least of these young offenders that they're talking about have huge underlying issues of mental health that have never been addressed and that are playing out in their actions. And unless this camp, this boot camp, includes intensive therapy and counselling, then all you're doing is you're whipping into submission young people who will be compliant outwardly and inwardly raging.
But they're young people who have repeatedly offended and got into a cycle of offending. In some cases, they are very serious offences. Do you not think that there needs to be something different in the way the system approaches them for this, you know, problem to be addressed?
Absolutely, I do. But what's different is not more punitive action. Punitive action is nothing different. I think what would be different is if finally somebody sat down and dealt with their issues of probably addiction, of depression, of PTSD, of all of those underlying issues of why they do these things in the first place. Guaranteed, those issues have never been dealt with. And my experience with older men who have gone on to be hardened criminals and in gangs, and women as well, is that those issues will come back to haunt them, will become prevalent in their lives, and will set them off again. So everybody I've talked to who've been in a boot camp-esque type situation in the past says it doesn't do anything but makes hardened criminals fitter criminals.
National, as well as this, they're putting forward $30 million for funding community groups to work with youth. So I guess that's more kind of aligned with what you're saying. Would you support that part of the policy?
Yeah, sure. As long as that $30 million goes to the right programs and the right groups. What traditionally I've seen is that the national government or any government, whoever it's been, likes to work with the organisations that are clean and tidy and do really good proposals and write really good tenders for procurement. But actually some of the people who actually understand the youth, who are doing amazing things at the grassroots, have no idea how to write a good tender or a good procurement policy. So people need to be out there looking at the grassroots organisations, understanding who are they, who are the ones who are making an actual difference in the lives of these young people, and put the money there and expand their ability to continue to help our young people. So, look, I get it. These are, Bill English has said, these are most hardened young criminals in the country, and we need to try something different. Well, we've been saying that for years because punitive action hasn't worked. And if we've been able to pick them up early and put the right services around them, then we could have avoided a whole lot of these things. Also, the other thing is if you turn these young people around, but they go back to the same communities, same hoods, same families, where their behaviour has escalated in the past, it will not be long before those old habits sink back in again, because they're unavoidable.
All right. And if we can just touch on your campaign launch you obviously had over the weekend, and you launched a number of new policies there. I wonder if you saw RNZ made you out to have kind of put this forward as a kingmaker position. Do you think you're in that sort of position of influence on the final outcome of this election?
Oh, I think it can be. I mean, if you looked at the last polls, it was before the Greens imploding and after the Jacinda effect came out. It said that even with Winston in either side of those camps, either both sides would still not have enough. The two little seats that we commanded would still be the ones to determine who ran the show. So we want to grow that vote, obviously, because what I do know is that neither side really wants to do a deal with Winston Peters.
Right, but for example, the Opportunities Party could just as easily be that one that makes all the difference. I mean, you're polling behind the Opportunities Party. There's a number of smaller parties dealing with 1 or 2%.
There's one difference. There's a major difference between us and the Opportunities Party is we hold a seat, and we intend to hold another 4 seats at least, and so the percentage party vote then needs to be higher than the seats that we win for anybody else to come in. The Opportunities Party could win 2%, 3% or 4%, but unless they cross the 5% threshold, they will get no seats. So, and we're fine actually to work with the Opportunities Party. We've had quiet talks with them on a number of occasions, And so a number of their policies are very similar to our policies.
Where are those seats going to come from, though? You say four seats, but, I mean, there have been concerns that you yourself won't be able to hold a position in Parliament.
The seats will be the Māori seats. We absolutely believe we'll win Tāmaki Makaurau. Absolutely believe we'll win Hauraki Waikato, Te Tai Hauāuru. And despite what others think, I believe that I can win Ikaro Rāwhiti. So we absolutely know that Tūturoa is going to win his seat. So Labour, who have taken themselves off the list, who say we're going to have the most Māori MPs in government if we get through, could actually end up with no MPs except for Calvin Davis, no Māori MPs except for Calvin Davis and Lewis Awal, if they're the only two who win their seats and we win the rest.
That was Marama Fox for the Māori Party.
The Wire.
This week on The Green Desk, Lily Peacock talks to the Waipua Forest Trust in Northland, home to Tane Mahuta.
Hello? If you can hear me, I'm sending this message from the year 2038 to tell you one thing. Lily was right.
Want a better future for the planet? Then listen up. This is The Green Desk with Lily Peacock, thanks to the Manukau Beautification Charitable Trust.
Today I'm speaking with Courtney Davis, the General Manager of the Waipua Forest Trust in Northland. Hi Courtney, how are you?
Hi Lily, I'm good.
That's good. Now tell me a little bit about the Waipua Forest.
Basically we have about 260 hectares of rejuvenating native kauri forest on the northern and southern catchment of the Waipua, the main Waipua sanctuary. So all the land that we have was previously all farmlands, and with grants over the years we've managed to purchase this farmland which we have replanted into a kauri forest.
Kauri dieback disease is going to be a bit of an issue there. Are you struggling with managing that at the site?
Well, we have quite a few protocols in place so we can effectively manage the spread of that disease. We have got wash stations and we're in the process of putting in a vehicle wash station. All the volunteers and people that we have who go into the forest, we make sure everyone washes their shoes properly before entering and leaving the forest. But yeah, it is a massive issue and something that we do have to work hard to manage.
What are some of the other issues that the forest is facing at the moment?
Pests at the moment. We have, we're lucky enough to have Kaitiaki Kiwi have trap lines in our lands, and they also have trap lines in the main sanctuary and around the area. We want to implement some, obviously, more pest control methods just because there are so many that we have to deal with.
And you've started a Pledge Me page to raise some money for the forest to help with that pest management, is that right?
Yes, that's right. We put an online fundraising campaign up about 2 weeks ago now, just so we can try and raise some money for the work that we're doing. Over winter, it's not as busy as it becomes in spring and summer, and we really have to work hard. I mean, not only do we have pests like rats, stoats, possums, weasels, we've also got weeds that we have to deal with.